Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do our desires for a kinder, safer, more equitable world gain traction over time? No matter where they live in the world, people born into poverty have numerous strikes against them. Poor women and girls can be especially vulnerable to human trafficking, domestic violence, unwanted pregnancy, and in some parts of the world, a lack of access to health services and education. But as filmmaker Mara Tchermayev demonstrates quite movingly in her three-part PBS documentary series A Path Appears, progress toward meaningful improvements can be made when people commit themselves to working toward them, even when it is clear that no complex problem has an easy solution. Part 2 of A Path Appears airs tonight at 9 on KERA Channel 13 Television. Part 3 airs next Monday. There's also a community screening event this Wednesday evening at Texas Woman's University. Mara, welcome to Think.
Thanks very much for having me, Chris.
So you worked very closely on this project with Cheryl Wudun and Nicholas Kristof, who, of course, have a book with the same title. Can you, first of all, explain the significance of that title for us?
The phrase "of path appears" actually comes from a Chinese poet, and what it really speaks to is that if one walks a right path again and again, where there was no path, a path will appear, meaning a solution will appear, meaning that there are options and there are ways to go, ways to walk that can make a difference.
I was so moved. I watched the first and second parts, by the way. I was so moved by so many of the stories, and especially by the fact that you choose to include the messy parts, the things that don't just get tied up neatly with a bow, and in fact leave the people involved with some questions about whether they are always doing exactly the right thing.
I think that's a very important part of trying to solve what seem like intractable and very, very, very large social issues, both here and around the globe. Nick Kristof, my colleague, who I should say mentor, really, because we've been working together since 2009. He likes to say there's no silver bullet, but there is silver buckshot. There is a way to sort of take a piece by piece by piece and look at some of the broad solutions and some of the specific solutions that can really bring about change. But it's important to show, you know, the hard road, because it is a hard road for many, and one has to get less judgmental. One has to, look around and see how they can get involved with opportunities. And I think opportunity is the key word, opportunities that can bring about change.
Shame is a really fascinating common factor for a lot of the people that we meet in these films. And if they are not ashamed of being poor exactly, often they find themselves ashamed of the horrible circumstances that poverty forces them into.
I agree. And and I think part of it is the shame of just knowing that they can't do more or they can't contribute more, or just the years of pressure and stress that come along with many of the difficulties that they face that they didn't really bring upon themselves. I mean, poverty is very, very difficult to get out of. It's very, very difficult. It's a cycle, poverty. And we have to look at some of the early roots and solutions as ways out. But many of the women that we met, while they felt shame or embarrassment or anger, justified anger sometimes at some of the circumstances that they find themselves in, you also meet some of the most resilient, most hardworking people who are really quite proud to be able to tell their stories and see if they can change the circumstances for others. Can their difficulty pave a different path for someone else? by sharing and by being open about their about the challenges they faced.
What are the conversations like when you speak to someone that you think might be an appropriate subject for the film because they are sort of putting their lives out there and many people will find themselves in their corner and many other people might look at them and continue to sort of judge them for ending up where they are?
Well, we talk a lot, both with the NGOs and different organizations that we work with on the ground, because mostly, you know, when Nick is writing a book, he can go and he and Cheryl can do research and talk to people and change their names. Or it's very different when you're making a documentary series, because we also don't tell things and show things that happened in the past. We might reference them, but we also want our audience to be very much a part of an ongoing, immediate story that's in the midst of happening. So we tend to you know, to work with organizations on the ground and as our route into finding subjects. And then we really have to be quite delicate because not everybody is emotionally prepared or does their story hit all the points that we need to touch on in order to completely present the scenario to an audience. So we do quite a bit of research and we probably talk to in the effort of making these three 90-minute films, we end up with, I don't know, some 25 stories per se, but we probably talk to about 100 or to 200 people to come to the right group who can, in combination, tell the right story.
The film that aired last week is available online, so we're not talking about anything that people have permanently missed. But it deals a lot with the issue of sex trafficking of women and girls. And anyone who still feels like prostitution is a choice that women make or that I suppose men make as well need only look at this and sort of recognize everybody found themselves in this circumstance that they never thought they would find themselves in, including people who were quite literally brought to this work by their parents.
Yeah, it was. I mean, episode one of the series is entirely about sex trafficking here in the United States. And you can watch it streaming on PBS.org. And then also the DVD is available through PBS Home Video. But it is that particular episode was very tough and very, very hard to film and hard to, you know, hard to find the best way to set out that story, because trafficking is truly one of the most egregious human rights violations imaginable. And to be trafficked and what trafficked means to be trafficked is something we had to, in a way, unpack, because people think of it as something that happened in another country. They think about it as something in Thailand or Cambodia or Vietnam. They don't think about American girls here at home. And the numbers are quite significant, you know, in terms of the young girls being trafficked. And what does it mean when you're trafficked? I mean, you talk about, you know, some of those girls are people that are sold by their own parents. And if they're not sold literally, they're just an after effect of drug abuse and addiction, or parents who had themselves fallen into prostitution, and it just becomes a cycle. But we did not meet any young girls, and most girls who are trafficked are brought into that life between the ages of 12 and 15 years old, very, very young. And most of them have already been victims of incest or rape preceding their entrance into a life of prostitution. And the Reverend Becca Stevens, who we worked with in Nashville, her wonderful organization, Magdalene and Thistle Farms, she actually had a line that I really love, which we actually have in the series, where she said, "If that's your choice, what were your options as far as entering into prostitution? Nobody would want to be living that life. It's a life that is riddled with addiction, vulnerability, danger, And it is happening in this country to girls far younger than consenting age.
The scenes where we as viewers are effectively driving along with a woman named Shauna who's really gotten her life together, but after a lot of struggles, completely opened my eyes. The things that I've been driving past, the people that I've been driving past, I just didn't realize. There's one scene, not only with young women, but there's like she not confronts, but sort of chats with a man that she knows to be a pimp. And the strangest mm-hmm. thing about that scene is that the pimp seems kind of weirdly avuncular. He doesn't seem like someone that, you know, like the movies clearly are getting this all wrong. And I don't mean
yes.
avuncular like kindly, but I mean you wouldn't suspect him of being a sex trafficker.
No, I agree. I mean, I think he's unusual to the untrained eye and not so unusual if you really have a sense of what life on the street is really like, because there's a huge range, as we know, of the idea of who a pimp or a madam is, and that can go from, you know, from Heidi Fleiss or Sidney Biddle. You know, there's so many sort of news stories that have come out about who these people are, but a lot of them are people just like the gentleman we met on the street, and I don't want to call him gentleman with too lightly.
Yeah.
I mean, he had three girls when Shauna pulled up the car with Ashley Judd and said, you know, hey, do you remember me? You know, and he comes right over and he says he's got three girls right now. He'd actually been imprisoned for both, both, I'm sure, for pimping of girls and also for drugs. And he reveals to Ashley that he's only, when he got out of prison, he was only out for a couple of hours or days before he just started right back up again. And there were three girls he was out with, each only bringing in $40. Sometimes it's $20. Sometimes it's $10. I mean, we were on the streets in Chicago and it's a very snowy day here in New York today. You know, we're in terrible weathers with girls with sweatpants. And, you know, and as Malin Ackerman, who was with us in Chicago, pointed out, this is not Pretty Woman.
Yeah.
That's a fantasy.
There's a point where Shauna goes up to a woman who is still working, a young woman who is still working as a prostitute, and says, when you want to quit, come find me and I'll help you. Aren't you tired? And the young woman just bursts into tears and says, yes, I'm so tired.
And yeah, I mean,
it's awful.
Yeah, she was actually, and Shauna says when she leaves us, she was such a beautiful girl. I think when Shauna says, are you ready to quit? She says, I'm tired. I'm so tired. I just want to get high one more time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something that the general public has to understand, which is that pimps really get, and traffickers get young girls hooked on all sorts of drugs from a very, very, very young age. And then they're dependent. And this isn't, Nick and Cheryl point this out, and we've discussed it a lot in the past couple of weeks. You know, this isn't somebody that you're in, you know, a joint business enterprise with.
Right.
The girls are getting nothing, and the pimps are taking everything, you know, financially. So these are girls with, you know, it's very difficult to escape. I mean, if you're a young girl who runs away from home, having had a typical teen or tween fight with your mom in middle America, and you're out on the street and you have no money and no way of taking care of yourself, I think the statistics are that you will be approached by a pimp in less than 48 hours.
My guest is filmmaker Mara Tremayev. Her film is called A Path Appears, Part 2 of 3, airs tonight. The next one is next Monday. There's a public screening event this Wednesday at Texas Woman's University. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs, accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
So, what was your childhood like, Lynn? What was your situation?
I mean, it was a rocky road. Never something special, you know. I was molested when I was younger by my adopted father, and, you know, I overcome it as I grew older.
Lynn, how old were you when that began happening to you?
I was 6, clear up till I was 14 is when I decided I had got my first real boyfriend, and I told him the situation, and he said, you know, that's not, because he was 18. And he said, you know, that don't sound right. And he told my father if he ever touched me, he'd really hurt him. And so it stopped there.
Do a lot of your girlfriends?
Of women.
Yeah, have a lot of women been suffered some kind of abuse?
I've heard
like that?
A lot of women have went through it. You went through it, didn't you? Yeah, mm-hmm. She went through it. That's why I became a stay-at-home mom, because of my past. You know, I don't want to miss a thing. I don't want to miss someone hurting my kids, you know.
You heard West Virginia resident Lynn Sargent telling Nicholas Kristof about how her past in poverty with an abusive father figure affects her choices as a parent. Episode 2 of A Path Appears airs tonight on KERA-TV at 9 o'clock. There's a community screening Wednesday at TWU. You can find information on the Think page. And now we're back to our conversation with the filmmaker who produced these documentaries, Mara Chermayev. Mara, you hear stories like this and... they're horrible, and yet Lynn, as you mentioned earlier, displays this sort of strength, but she's in a tough spot. She's got a lot of challenges that come from poverty, and things like early intervention in her kids' lives may be the difference between them sort of repeating a similar path or being able to take a different one.
I agree. And we very much believe, and when I say we, I speak of Nick Kristof and Cheryl Wudun and the filmmaking team. We all really see early childhood interventions and education as absolute definitive markers for change. I mean, they make such an enormous difference. And it's very hard sometimes to convince, you know, whether it's government or the financial investment side of tackling these insurmountable issues like poverty, to say if you make these investments on the front end, you will make a much wiser and less costly investment than trying to solve these problems on the back end with jails and with imprisonment and lack of education and lack of job opportunity and drug addiction and all the vulnerabilities that come when you don't have any opportunities. So early childhood is really important. And when we were in West Virginia, which is where Lynn is living, we worked very closely with Save the Children, who's doing a very, very valuable home intervention work in that area.
And of course, people may think of the name Save the Children and they think about international work when in fact there's, you know, poverty here in this country that sort of cries out for services like the ones they provide.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that even in a way quite attuned to these issues, I even felt that. I think I didn't was not aware until I started working directly with Save and how much good work they're doing here in the U.S. And Jennifer Garner, who traveled with us to her home state in West Virginia, and we were peeling back the onion of what was going on in her hometown. And, you know, she has been a spokesperson and, you know, had a lot of opportunities as to what organization she could get involved with. And she was very much supportive of, I'd like to give my time to Save the Children. I can see they're doing amazing work, and they are.
So people heard you say Jennifer Garner. You mentioned Ashley Judd earlier. There are Blake Lively, some other celebrities. To be clear, for people who are now rolling their eyes and thinking, okay, this is a photo op, can you kind of explain, these are people who are actually already involved in these causes? And do you bring them on because that does bring a certain segment of an audience that maybe otherwise wouldn't tune into something as serious as this material?
Yeah. I mean, we absolutely do. And we're fairly forthright about it because, honestly, I mean, there's been a long history of people, you know, celebrities, as we'll call them, advocates, getting in very, very involved with human rights causes. And many of those actors and advocates are very, very serious about that. I mean, Angelina Jolie, George Clooney, I mean, we can name so many. And the women that we chose to work with, these are people that are doing very, very, very serious and important work. And they're lending their name and their energy and their audience and helping to shine a light on people that are doing good work on the ground. These are not people saying, hey, you know, look at me. They're saying, what can I do with this audience that I have from being in the film business or the television business or being a recording artist? I mean, we worked, in our luminary capacity, you know, we also worked with musicians like Alicia Keys. I mean, people that are really doing a lot. But we struggled because, you say roll your eyes. I mean, even we had that moment where we were like, questioning whether this was the best way to bring an audience. But Nick Kristof is, has two columns, and he and Cheryl together have written four books, best-selling books. They're Pulitzer Prize winners. They have an audience themselves. I mean, Nick has, you know, close to 2 million Twitter followers and Facebook fans as the sort of tireless journalist advocate that he is. But it's very different than Eva Longoria, for instance, who has 6 or 7 million Twitter followers. And all of that social media begins to have an impact. And what Nick and we all talked about is that we wanted to go beyond the choir. We wanted to not just talk to people who probably likely already felt the same way that we do. Or felt that these issues were important. We wanted to reach people who maybe hadn't thought about them at all. And all of the talent was a huge, huge benefit to help to shine a light and to sort of turn the spotlight. As Nick sometimes says, we're in the lighting business. We're about shining a light on other people that are doing that work on the ground, whether that's in their own home state or home city here in the U.S. or on the ground in their countries, which we visit in this series, Haiti. We were in Cartagena, Colombia. We were in Kenya. And we want people to know who's doing that work on the ground and help to lift them to have more opportunities to do it better.
Well, let's talk about Haiti, a poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, frequently targeted for foreign aid. Why do Haitians tend to view those interventions with skepticism?
They probably have the right to. I mean, I think that there's a lot of money that's gone into Haiti. Some of it, we're not quite sure where it went. And on the other hand, Haiti has issues that go back, you know, long before the earthquake. It's had, government and leadership issues, infrastructure issues for many, many, many years of, you know, extremely difficult and oppressive governments and overthrows. And then you add, the additional nightmare of the earthquake and the death toll and the difficulty that still spirals today from that. And, you know, you have a lot of aid going in, but you're not seeing enough internal solutions. We actually felt quite positive after our time in Haiti in the sense that we did meet incredible Haitian people on the ground doing substantive work. I mean, Rhea Dole, who runs the Sopadep School for Girls, which we were following, she's most of her money is coming from abroad, not from Haiti. But she's doing really good work with her people. And that's something that we want to support because Haitians and anywhere in the world, they know their own people. They know their challenges. And solutions that come from within are usually proven to be the most long-lasting. So Haiti has a way to go. When you get on a plane and you, you know, fly an hour and a half from Miami or, you know, New York, and you realize that you're not in the middle of Central Africa, but you're right off the coast of the United States of America, or you're right next to the Dominican Republic, where, you know, people are on, you know, swimming holidays. It's almost unfathomable, but it is so.
I was horrified to get a close look at this bizarre system of institutionalized, sort of legally sanctioned child trafficking in Haiti, the RESTAVEC system.
Yes.
Tell us how that works.
Well, I think that a lot of it comes from poverty in the countryside, you know, lack of family planning resulting in women having 10, 12, 14 children that they simply can't afford to care for, can't afford to feed, can't afford to provide any kind of transportation that would take them to a local school, or they're, you know, they're so distant from any viable or reasonable school program, as the public education system in Haiti is still struggling. And they end up, for lack of a better word, sort of selling their children, and or placing them sometimes naively into families that are living in the city, and in exchange for them being able to go to school. You can live with this family. You can essentially be a boarder at this family, and you'll you know, you'll work for them to some degree, and as a result, you will have access to an education. And it's you know, it's a system that has gone on through many cultures and many countries, but maybe not as severely as I saw it in Haiti. And I think it has a past of being worse than it is today. And there were examples. I mean, Rhea Dole herself and her sister were both RESTAVEC, and her sister had gone to, you know, a fairly reasonable, I mean, excuse me, she had gone to a fairly reasonable family, her sister not. So there are times when it does give you that leg up, but very often it just opens the door for abuse, whether that's, you know, slave labor abuse, where little children are you know, are really, you know, taken in as slaves for a family. And we're not talking about going to a wealthy family in the city. There were people that we met living in, you know, USAID provided sort of, you know, tent villages on a hillside that had a RESTAVEC child. Hmm. And they themselves were in extreme poverty. And most of those girls went to school in the afternoon, as did the young girl Marilyn, who we followed, and ultimately was saved from an abusive family in partnership with the RESTAVEC Freedom Foundation, which is an organization in Haiti who really tries to fight for the rights of these young women and boys as well.
Marilyn's story is so compelling. So it's discovered, she finally reveals to her teachers that her RESTAVEC family is physically abusing her. But the situation is not quite as simple as simply pulling her out of there and reporting the abuse to authorities. Again, we come to this place where something has to be done, but it's not altogether clear the best way to go.
Indeed. It's such a gray world. It's never the black and white dream story. And we had these visions of, oh, we're going to take Marilyn back. She's going to see her mother. Her mother, actually, who didn't know or had not seen her since before the earthquake, who thought she'd probably died in the earthquake. And yet you get back to a home of total poverty. Her mother and her father or stepfather had, you know, sort of found a way to get rid of her. And she had 12 other children and absolutely no way to provide for them. And it was not an easy solution to just say, oh, my missing daughter, you know, welcome home. How could this have happened to you? It isn't like that. And that was tough. But I want to add, because it actually just arrived today, a wonderful, wonderful note from Marilyn to us at A Path Appears, to Nick and to Cheryl and to all of our film partners, saying, I just want you all to know that being involved in this project saved my life. Mm. And I'm at Restavec Freedom Home with the other girls. I'm doing so well. I have so many friends. I didn't know that it was possible that my life could change on a dime. I mean, it's a lovely letter. I actually think we're going to post it on our apathappears.org on our blog and let our viewers read this really it was really rewarding to know that that somebody that was at such risk, like Marilyn, now is set forth on a better path.
Well, thank you for sharing that bit of it with us, and we'll look forward to finding it online. I have to say, in terms of just filmmaking, the reunion with her mother was one of the most heart-wrenching things I have ever seen in a documentary, because the conventions of storytelling led me to expect one thing, maybe the same thing you were expecting, which was that, poor or not, there would be this embrace and they would sort of tear up. And it was this weird, cold, her mother doesn't quite know what to do with her. And it's just, she's stunned. Marilyn is stunned that what she dreamed of, nobody wants her back at home.
And also that she didn't want to stay back at home. She wasn't a little village girl anymore. You know, she was one of 12, and she was only 11 years old at the time, turning 12. And she had already been in the city in this abusive situation for 5 years, I think. So already she was a little girl when she'd been left. She didn't even remember. It was her fantasy of another life. And when she really saw the circumstances and saw her mother, who was so beaten down, I mean, she was warm. I think she was happy to see her in many ways and embarrassed by what had happened. But she had no tools. She had no capacity to take Marilyn back. And when we were traveling on that particular journey with Alfre Woodard, and Alfre was just in tears and said, we can't leave her here. And we all, you know, it was quite complicated because, you know, we are not driving the circumstances. We're journalists and we're filmmakers and we're part of what's happening, but we can't dictate or change people's lives. But it was very, very harsh and very sad.
I have to jump in here really quick. We have a break in 10 seconds. My guest is Mara Shermayev. Her film is A Path Appears.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
In Cartagena, there are probably, for sure, 5,000 teenage moms a year. And we only have room for less than 10%.
Buenos dias. Hola. ¿Cómo están? ¿Puedo entrar?
Right now, Damalis is 6-7 months pregnant. He started prostitution at a very early age.
Mamá, ven. Dos hijos se le murieron.
Her mom is, she's having a lot of economic problems. She earns $8 a day. And $7 she needs to pay debts, to pay the funeral of her own son.
Uno fue porque lo mató la pandilla. El otro,
Damalis saw her mom with a lot of economic problems and she wanted to help her mom. She had this friend. She was in a prostitution. And she kept telling her, let's go to Barranquilla because over there we're going to earn money.
¿Eras consciente de lo que significa ir a la prostitución?
¿O simplemente te aventajaste porque una amiga te dijo?
Me aventajé.
She wasn't aware. She just said, as a teenager, I'm going to go for it.
You heard Catalina Escobar, who is founder and director of Juan Fe, interpreting an interview with a potential client in Cartagena, Colombia. The young woman became pregnant after falling into prostitution. Episode 2 of A Path appears tonight on KERA-TV at 9 o'clock. We are speaking with filmmaker Mauro Jeremiev. Mauro, the scenes in Cartagena are really surprising. 30% of births in Cartagena are to teenage women.
I know. It was, I mean, we were so shocked when we first went down and we were scouting the story. I mean, we knew that Kata was a you know, show of force. She was a pile of energy. She had so much drive to make change. So we knew that she was a wonderful character to introduce to people and a wonderful story in her own right. But we didn't really, we were questioning, gee, I wonder if this, you know, this issue in Cartagena is really that, you know, that notable. And in fact, we walked into the barrios, into the very poor areas, and literally look to your left, look to your right. Every step was a pregnant girl, and a pregnant girl, some as young as 12, 11. There was an 11-year-old pregnant girl that we met holding a tiny baby, and she just was, it was babies having babies. It was really unprecedented. It was shocking.
What accounts for that rate? I mean, we know what accounts for it, but why is it particularly bad in Cartagena?
I think it's bad in Cartagena. I think it's bad in a lot of places in the world. I mean, I think that there is, I think there's not a lot of access or acceptable methods of birth control for poor girls in that part of the world. I think there's a kind of a barrio gang life in the streets in those areas, you know, with music, and you know, there's the kids are just sort of all running wild. There's no real the education, again, they're dropping out of school incredibly young. So I'm not sure it's any factor that wouldn't be the same factors that you would find in other places. It just seemed quite extreme, and it may be the way that the way that we were there and following Kata's focus. Because I have to say, I've also seen incredible amounts of young women with children at a very, very early age in many countries in Africa as well, and less so here a little bit. But I think teenage pregnancy, as we know, I mean, there's, you know, what do we have, like 2 or 3 reality shows on in this country about being pregnant at the age of 16. I think it's an ongoing problem. And then it has a ripple effect of problems that comes from it. It was really great to be able to bring this subject matter to public television, though, because there's so many places that don't tackle these big issues and don't see the opportunities on the other side and the sort of positive side of telling these stories. So, you know, PBS and CPB and ITVS and that independent voice that can go on to public television is still. It's important to hear these stories. It's important to know, and you meet great people in the process. You meet wonderful, wonderful characters.
So this woman, I'm sorry, please continue.
No, it's fine.
This woman, Catalina, she has this program, and she provides job training and lots of, you know, kind of interventions that will allow these young mothers not only to help their own children, but to perhaps, you know, have some influence over their peers when they get back home. I'm wondering, though, for you, not that you're getting wealthy as a public television documentarian, but knowing that you could, you know, reach into your checking account and, you know, find $500 and make a huge difference, but you can't do that for every subject. I mean, how do you, you know, when you go into a situation where you know that everybody that you're interviewing in a room is hungry, like, what do you do with that?
Well, it's hard. I mean, it's very hard. I mean, we do have a very large mission, and we see ourselves as our job is to tell those stories and to get those stories out there. Because without a voice and without being heard, it will just bury deeper and deeper for all of these people. I mean, in terms of the single girls or people that we work with, we often do help them. I mean, this is in a sense a sequel to our first series, which was on PBS in 2012, Half the Sky: Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide, which was all in the Global South and came from Nick and Cheryl's best-selling book. So this was in a way our follow-up, and in that program, we, all of the people, and our actress advocates as well, ended up supporting the education of girls. I mean, if girls were extremely vulnerable, we organized with our NGO partners and moved them into boarding schools or places that they would be safer. And we, you know, so in a way, we do end up pulling up, from our own pockets. But part of what we're trying to tell our viewers and our audiences, it isn't always just about money and writing a check. A check would be great. But even as Rachel Lloyd says, become a big brother or a big sister or volunteer with organizations like Save the Children. Find out what's going on in your community, because it isn't just whether you can write a check. It's what do you have? What personal skill set can you bring to help other people, whether that's volunteering or whether that's a small amount of money or a large amount of money. But in terms of us as filmmakers, we are constantly involved with all of our subjects because once you get it, once you go to that place with people, you just can't you can't really turn your back on them.
When anybody thinks about the magnitude of the kinds of problems that you prevent in this series, they seem insurmountable, and it seems, like no matter what one does, it's not fully scalable. But I wonder if you feel like the perfect is the enemy of the good, and you know what I'm saying? Like knowing that you can't solve the whole thing, but you still have to do something.
You can, but you can chip away at it. And you can also see where some of the vulnerabilities lie. I mean, in Cata's, at Juanfe, the one Felipe Gomez Foundation, she has some pretty strict rules. She's a tough mom in a lot of ways. I mean, it's hard to get into to be accepted. And then when you do, there's a lot of sort of rules and things that you have to be part of. And you do get training and skill set. It has to be your first baby that you're pregnant with. You can't have another baby. If you have another baby, you're released from the program. So she has, and it's tough love. But what she's trying to do is find, is offer that hand out. But also, the girls have to understand the hard work that's involved with, we always talk about it, pulling up your own bootstraps. Well, that's hard to do. And it's really hard to do when you're being, when someone's pushing down your head at the same time. So she tries to, and we all should, try to have that empathy, have that hand that we put out. But ultimately, you have to find and you have to encourage individuals to understand what they need to be and do to affect a long-term solution and change. And everyone I've met jumps at the chance.
It's so interesting when we first meet Damalise. She's a mess. She has doesn't want to make eye contact. She seems very just sort of damaged in terms of her self-esteem. And she's in this tough spot because she has no way to support this child she's expecting. And Catalina says, because you see the other women who are in the program and they all seem like they're doing okay. And she says they all come in like that.
They do. And they also struggle. I mean, Damalise is still struggling. I mean, because it's very hard to have everything change and then to have all of these responsibilities. Because the other thing that we always, forget when we talk about young girls that have been trafficked or young teen moms is that they're still very young. They don't have a long view yet. So you have to try to help them to have a long view. I mean, it's pretty compelling when you're starving, and it's pretty compelling when you have a baby and you have nowhere to sleep and nowhere to go and nothing to eat, and then a set of opportunities comes your way with an organization or with something like what Kata's offering. But you know, it doesn't come easily, and it's hard. And Damalis is still struggling. She was actually quite, you know, her brother was killed by the gangs. You know, her mother was terribly worried and struggling. But you know, Damalis had an attitude that so many young teenage girls do. But it just gets harder and harder if you don't have. It's one thing to rescue someone per se. And it's another thing for that person to then have the tools to create their own life. And that's what Kata talks about when she, you know, talks about jobs and skill sets and whether those are in, you know, restaurants or tourism. And she really wants people to be trained so that they can get a job. And the same thing happens with Thistle Farms in Nashville. I mean, once you take a girl that's been trafficked and has been abused for many years off the street, then what? She needs to heal. She needs support systems. She needs to have economic viability. And so it's not just noticing that they're there and then having a great organization or a great opportunity to pull them out. The then what is very, very important. And we all as a society have to be part of the then what, because they're going to need to make themselves and have the opportunities to make themselves viable members of the community. That's when, you know, their children won't, you know, that's how you break the cycle.
So people can see part one online, part two tonight on TV, and you don't absolutely have to see all three for it to make sense. But tell us a little bit about what's coming up in part three.
Part three addresses something very important, which has, of course, been on everybody's mind since the Super Bowl, which is domestic violence here in the United States, in which, you know, we know is a very difficult and very hidden issue. I mean, as Nick's pointed out to me, and we actually have it in the film as well, in domestic violence here in the U.S., between 2001 and 2006, four times more women were killed here as a result of domestic violence than in the wars combined between 2001 and 2006. So that's, I mean, we're talking about, you know, every 2 minutes, 40 women are assaulted in a domestic violence situation. It's truly at arrestingly frightening numbers. So we do a story and work with some organizations in Atlanta on domestic violence, and then we do a really sort of 360-degree holistic NGO based in Kenya, Shining Hope for Communities. Kennedy Odede and Jessica Posner, an unbelievably great story that Nick and I have. And Cheryl and the Path to Peers team have returned to tell a bigger story. We talked about them a bit in Half the Sky, but we really wanted to tell a bigger story about the work that they're doing in the slums of Kibera and the girls' school that they founded, the Kibera School for Girls, which is just unbelievable, and sort of showing that if you have an organization and you have the will and you have the way and you're accountable, you can make so much change.
Mara Shermayev directed the three-part documentary series A Path Appears. Part 2 airs tonight at 9 on KERA Channel 13 Television. Part 3 airs next Monday. There's a community screening event this Wednesday evening at Texas Woman's University. Mara, it's such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thanks, and thanks to all the listeners who appreciate independent lens and important stories on PBS. That's where to find them.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker, engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.